All right, well, take your Bibles, turn to Ephesians chapter 6. We spent some time in Matthew 19 this morning, looking at where Jesus, as I remember, is only direct addressing the issue of singleness. Kind of messes us up. We don't always know how to deal with that text because he doesn't say singles, he says eunuchs, and that kind of throws us off, but he really is addressing the issue of singleness there. Oh, yeah. Great. Ephesians 6, we're going to read verses 1 through 3. And then we will begin trying to unpack this text here this morning. Ephesians 6, I'm starting in verse 1. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honor your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, so that it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth. This weekend, we're dealing with issues concerning marriage, and family, and singleness. Yesterday, we considered the roles of husbands and wives. This morning, the issue of singleness. And today, we're going to look at what God says to children. Now, we're going to look at it in three aspects here. First of all, we want to know concerning what God says to children. We'll take a look at the content. In other words, what is it that he says? We'll be very brief there. Secondly, we'll look at the significance. In other words, what God says to children, we really want to know what it means. What's going on behind these couple of commands that God gives? And then thirdly, we want to understand the purpose. What is all this driving at? In other words, why does he say it? Okay, let's start with the content here. It's really two commands that God gives to children. The first one is obey your parents, and the second one is to honor your parents. And after he gives these two commands, he then gives one promise, so that the promise is that it will be well with you. So two commands, obey your parents, honor your parents. And then there's this promise attached to that, which is that it will go well with you. In other words, this is the content. This is what God commands children and the accompanying promise with it. This is the right time to go ahead and define some of our terms here. Just like we did with singles this morning, we took a little bit of time in the introduction to make sure we understand who we're talking about. A single is not just the type of single that we typically think of, which is someone that's a young adult waiting to get married. It's much, much broader than that. Well, when it comes to children, I want to go ahead and take a moment to clarify, who is it we're talking about? All of us are children, in the sense that all of us have parents. Now, I guess if we want to get a little nitpicky about the term, there would be some of us that are no longer children, in the sense that our parents no longer are living, and that because maybe may very well be the case for some of you here. But when we talk about children, the tendency in English is to think of it in terms of young children, but that's not really the case of how this word is used. A lot of my time is spent working in another language, in Spanish, and in Spanish we actually break it down. There's the word niño, which really refers to children that are young, that are children in the sense that we think of it in English. Then they have the word hijo, which is a word that is also the word for children, but it doesn't give nothing attached there to age. And it really helps us in Spanish to understand what Paul is saying here. And so in English, it's a little more difficult, but I want you to, let's be clear on our terms here. When we're talking about children, we're talking about about a person's relationship to their parents. And I think it's important that we understand that there are two basic types of transitions in the life of a person, the life of a child. And again, I'm not talking about a young child. I'm talking about someone who has parents. Two basic transitions that affect a child's relationship to his or her parents. The first one is marriage. When a person gets married, biblically, there is a change that takes place in that person, whether he's a man or a woman, and that person's relationship to his parents. Genesis 2:24 is a very, very crucial text. What Genesis 2:24 tells us is that when a person gets married, he actually, it affects two of his relationships. It affects, first of all, his relationship to his parents, because what God said, and by the way, this is from the beginning, this is before sin entered the world. I mean, this is very foundational stuff. When a person gets married, it first of all affects his relationship to his parents. He leaves that relationship. In a sense, he cuts that off. It says there that a man leaves his father and mother. And what does that mean? It means that his relationship with his father and mother, which previously was dominated by these two concepts, obeying them and honoring them. And that is fundamentally affected when a person gets married. Now, we're going to unpack exactly what that means a little bit later on. But there is a fundamental breaking of that. Why is that? And the purpose is really what we're driving at. It is not because he's just throwing that relationship to the wind. Not at all. It is very purpose-driven. A person, when he gets married, leaves his father and mother for the purpose of clinging to, of cleaving to, of becoming attached now to in a very distinct relationship. And that is his relationship with his wife. You see, a family is father, mother, and the products, the children of that relationship. But when one of those children grows up and gets married, it is the leaving of a previous relationship for the purpose of forming this new entity. And so there is a fundamental change in what a person, whether he's a woman or a man, his or her relationship with his parents when he or she gets married. Now, the other type of transition, this one's a little, it's not quite as clear, but I think it's equally valid in the sense that when a person, again, male or female, becomes economically, and again, that's too simple of a term, but it's the best term I can think of in the moment, becomes economically independent of his or her parents, there is a change in the relationship that takes place. In other words, there's something that connects dependence and responsibility, always. In other words, if I'm dependent on somebody, then I am inevitably responsible in some way to that person. That's the way a work relationship works. If I work for a business, I am in one sense dependent for my salary on that business. So that means I have a certain level of responsibility to that business. And as soon as I quit, or as soon as I'm fired, I no longer have the same responsibility to that business. Why? Because my dependence on that business is no longer in existence. There is a change. And I think it's right to view the relationship of a child to his parents in that if you are a young person who in one way or another continues economically dependent, whether it means you live in their home or economically your parents are still footing the bill for a number of things, until there is really a pure economic independence, there is a responsibility there that really places you within the realm very clearly of what Ephesians 6, 1 and 2 says. Now, this is a side issue, but let me just mention it briefly. My in-laws, and I want to be careful because I'm in the presence of many of my family here, my in-laws were very, very wise when Cheryl and I first got married. Cheryl and I were most poor when we were first married. We spent the first 3 years of our lives, me trying to get through seminary, working like crazy, Cheryl working like crazy, and barely being able to get to the end of the month without going into debt. God allowed us by His grace for me to go to seminary, spend 2.5 years there married to Cheryl. We started without debt. We ended without debt by God's grace. Now, that time of our lives, my in-laws economically could have stepped in and helped us. And they did on a very limited basis. They actually help us more now when we're in less need of it than before. And I look back at that and I am very, very grateful. Do you know why? Because I think, and I haven't really talked it through with them, but I think there was this understanding in their thinking that economic dependence inevitably creates a responsibility. And that when a couple is newly married, what they need is what Genesis 2:24 describes. They need to learn to leave the one relationship with the parents to cling to the new relationship, to the husband and the wife. They were very wise with us because they gave me the freedom and my wife the freedom, even economically, to cling to each other, to make decisions without being affected by that previous tie. And they allowed us that freedom to really form this new entity across the board. Now, I say that because I want to encourage you who are parents and your children are reaching that point. What Scripture outlines for us is always the foundation, always has to be the foundation for our thinking. And so as you look toward that with your children later on, or if your children are already in that, remember what is most important is not your married children's relationship to you. It is that they form this new entity, their marriage, and that they have freedom to do that. Because there's an inevitable connection between dependency and responsibility. Now, that was a side issue. But it drives it kind of, I clarify that because it really affects how we understand what Paul says in Ephesians concerning children obeying their parents and honoring them. When you look at it, obedience is, in a sense, the foundational part. Honoring takes obedience and it just fills it out completely. And so when a young person who is still single, say, but is economically independent of his parents, how should he view his relationship to his parents? In a sense, some of the obedience aspect is broken, especially when a person is married. A wife, for example, is not responsible to obey her father any longer. She is primarily responsible to submit to her husband. That's what Scripture teaches us. When a single person is economically independent of his parents, it is not the same relationship of obedience. What does remain always intact, and what Jesus really drove at when he talked with the Pharisees about the issue of children and their parents, is really the second one of honoring their parents. You see, obedience is a very direct responsibility-related relationship, but honoring is something that continues the rest of your life. I always have to honor my parents, even though I really am not responsible to obey them in the way that I was before. And so, this is the content of what Paul is saying to children. Children, if you live in the home, if you in any way are economically dependent on your parents, if you are not married, if you fall into any of those categories, really, then this is what the Apostle Paul, this is what God primarily says to you. What is the content of it? Two commands: obey your parents, honor your parents. One promise: it will go well with you. Now, what does it mean? What is the significance of these commands? Let's take the first one, obey, and let's break it down. This word obey, the Greek word that Paul uses here, is really a special word, because this word has, outside of how we understand obey, it actually has one other special significance. We're talking about the word that Paul used when he said, children, obey your parents. That Greek word there, it has a different usage, which is that it was used in this instance when a porter, when someone that worked, for example, in the house of a rich man, when a porter would hear someone knock at the door, then he was expected to do two things. He was expected to hear that, to listen for that, and he was expected to respond by opening the door. Now, I want to show you one verse. You don't have to turn there. I've put it up on the screen here. It's very interesting context where you see this word come out. In Acts 12, verse 13, Peter has been in jail. God miraculously sends this angel who gets him out of the prison. He doesn't even know if he's in a dream or if it's really happening until he gets out of the prison. He gets to the gate of the city. He finds out, he realizes this is for real. He turns around to address the angel. The angel's gone. So what does Peter do? He says, well, I'm free now. So he walks to the house of John Mark or John Mark's mother or mother-in-law. And he gets there. And look at what happens in this verse. It says, and when he knocked at the door of the gateway, a servant girl named Rhoda, and it translates it here, came to answer. But you know what that word came to answer is? It's the same word that Paul uses in Ephesians 6 when he says, obey. So what does it tell us? Well, what does the girl here who's waiting to listen for knocks at the door do? She hears the knock, she listens to that, and then she obeys. In other words, she responds. She comes to answer. That is the way this word was used. Now, what does that tell us about how children ought to obey their parents? Well, it's simple. When I tell my daughter Lauren, for example, to do something, when I say, Lauren, I want you to go up and help your mother in the kitchen. She's getting supper ready. What is Lauren supposed to do if she is going to do what Paul says, obey her parent? Two things. First, she has to hear it. And a lot of times, that's where she gets messed up. Do you know what I'm talking about? She has to listen. She has to take her nose out of the book, or she has to stop doing this or that. She has to actually listen to me. But there's a second thing. She then has to respond. She has to go open the door. She has to go to the kitchen and say, Mom, Dad sent me in to see if there's any help. What can I do to help you get supper ready? She has to actually move her body. She has to respond and obey. If I say, Micah, take your feet off the couch, he has to hear me. And with Micah, many, many times, that's where the problem really begins. Is, Micah, didn't I tell you that? I didn't hear you. And often, I really don't think he's lying to me. He's very often in his own little world. So often for me, it's getting his attention. So there's no question concerning that first part. So it's, did you hear me? Yes, I'm hearing you. Are you hearing me with your brain, not just with are you really listening? And then there has to be a positive response. In other words, he has to do what I've expected him to do. Children, let me address you directly for a moment. When your father speaks, when your mother speaks, these are the two things that God expects you to do. You must listen and you must respond. It is hearing them and it is opening the door. It is responding positively. It's obeying that. Now, there's something deeper going on here. Because logistically, it sounds very, very simple, doesn't it? I mean, as soon as someone knocks at the door, usually the child hears that and they go, I wonder who's at the door, and they run to the door. Do they not? Typically? Most of them. Some don't, maybe, but most of them. So it's not, logistically, it's quite simple. Then why isn't it that simple in our homes? Why does it get so complicated? And the answer is because we're dealing with this issue called submission to authority. You see, obedience is not just about me as a father getting my child to do what I want. It's not about that at all. It's not about you as a mother getting your child to behave in a way that makes you look good. It's not about that at all. It is about a child learning submission to authority. It's interesting in our culture over the last 30 or 40 years, if you go back to the 1950s, the post-World War II generation, do you know what was prized and what was glorified and what was sought after in our culture? It was authority and leadership. One of the most famous broadcasters in America, Tom Brokaw, wrote a book called The Greatest Generation. What was he talking about? He was talking about those Americans and Europeans and Canadians and Australians who went and fought World War II, the greatest generation, and came home and, like in the United States, for example, built this unbelievable interstate system. And they began to throw up skyscrapers. And they began to do great things, the greatest generation. Why? Because they understood authority. And they understood how to get things done. And how did they rear their children? Via authority. How did they fail? They tended to be overbearing. And so what generation came next? The 1960s. And what did the young people in the 1960s want? Anything but authority. Why? It's logical. Their parents tended to be overbearing. It was the greatest generation. And so in the 1960s, they threw it all to the wind. And in a sense, we're living still now with the children and the grandchildren of that generation. And they don't want any authority. I wonder at times, will it get so chaotic that there rises a generation that goes back to a strong view of authority? Don't be surprised if that's where it goes. Now, where are we at today? We're in a situation where nobody wants to be overbearing. No, nobody wants you to spank your children. Nobody wants you to have a home where you expect obedience, where the children are expected to submit to authority. We don't want to, psychologically, it's like we're going to mess them up and we're going to oppress them, and they need freedom of thought. And what Paul outlines is simplicity. It's not complicated. It is the simplicity of learning submission to authority. Now, it gets complicated real quick. It gets complicated in my home. And what is the best help to me? It is in my own thinking and talking with my wife, coming back to what do our children need? They need to learn submission to authority. Not because it benefits me, even though it does, and not because it benefits her, but because it benefits my child. Because it teaches them how to understand life and God. Now, let's break it down briefly. What are the two things that really are behind this issue of submission to authority? Two reasons, and they're really the same, they're two sides of the same coin, and I want you to see it that way. One, a person will never find satisfaction, will never find fulfillment outside of an understanding of God as Creator and Lord. You seek satisfaction in something outside of understanding that there is a God, that He is Creator, and that He is Lord. That He is authority. If you want some other kind of God, then you're going to seek it and you will never find satisfaction. You will find it temporarily and it will inevitably leave you empty. Why? Because the God we serve is the Creator and He is Lord. And His story is the story. And until you learn to understand His story and to fit into submission to His authority, Nothing will make sense. Sharon and I were talking about a friend of hers from high school who sought his fulfillment and submission in one marriage. It didn't work out, so he abandoned that. He sought it in another marriage. He abandoned that, and it seems like now he's seeking it in a homosexual relationship. The cycle will go on. We're not shocked. I'm not surprised at that. Because until you seek your fulfillment and your satisfaction and understanding God is my Creator and He is my Lord and I must submit to Him, you won't find it. So why do we teach our children that? Or why do we need to teach submission to authority, it's not for our benefit primarily. It is because we want them to understand God and life and fulfillment. We want them to have what we call a Christian worldview. Now, what's the other side of that coin? It is that the child desperately needs to learn to get outside of himself. He needs to think about things outside of himself. In other words, he needs to learn that he is not, that she is not the center of the universe. As I look at my children, my deepest concern for them is not so much that they behave well. I like them to behave well. I feel better about myself. It's not as embarrassing. But that's not my primary concern. If that is my primary concern, then I'm being self-centered, and that's going to totally complicate my child rearing. My primary concern has to be that my child learns to get out of himself, so that he can learn to understand who God is. So why does a child need to learn to obey? It really has to do with getting out of himself so that he can fully understand God. Now, what's the other thing God says to children? He says to honor them. He says to honor your parents. What does this mean? It really means two things. Number one, it means that the child ought to value his parents. It means that a child should value their commands and expectations. You as a child should value your parents' teaching, their instruction, their counsel. If you are an adult, if you are married, you are no longer under submission to obey your parents. However, you should honor your parents. If your parents counsel you, then you should listen to it, and you should mull over it, and you should think about it. In the end, you may reject their counsel. If you come to the conclusion that God is pushing you a different direction, but it should never be lightly. No, no. It should be, if you reject your parents' counsel, it should be with legitimate, serious consideration. Because honoring your parents means that you value them. And young people, even young marrieds who have a lot of interaction with your parents, especially if your parents are Christians, that is the way you respond to them. If you are a young child, if you're a child still in the home, elementary school age or high school age, your life should be characterized by an honoring, a valuing of your parents. The other aspect is the issue of respect. And when we talk about respecting parents, what we're getting at is really how you talk. It's your reactions. It's your attitude. It's the quality of your obedience. Because there's good obedience and bad obedience. And the good obedience is honoring, and the bad obedience is not honoring to your parents. We're talking about your decisions. We're talking about how you spend your time. You see, you can respect your parents in all of these ways. It has to do with the tone of voice. It has to do with the type of reaction. It has to do with the look on your face. And so, children, honor your parents by valuing them and by respecting them. Now, the third thing I want you to consider here. We've looked at the content. What does God say to children? Honor your parents, obey your parents. We've looked at what it means to obey, what it means to honor. And now, what is the purpose? In other words, why does God say all this? What is he driving at? And this is where, to me, it really gets interesting. Because Everything we've looked at to this point, in a sense, could be a little self-centered. I mean, look at it, parents. If you're a parent, especially if you have children still in the home, I mean, it's really convenient when your parents obey, is it not? It's just a lot more convenient. It's a lot less hassle. When your parent, when your children honor you, it just feels a lot better. It's easier. It's not as embarrassing. It's not as complicated. Is it not? And actually, if it ended here, our tendency, we would inevitably head toward a self-centered understanding of this. But Paul doesn't end it there. God doesn't let it end there. It's not just obey your parents, honor your parents, let's move on. He gives this promise. And you look at this, and why does Paul go all the way back to the Ten Commandments, to the giving of the law, and grab this promise and remind his readers of this? Why does he do that? What's the purpose? And let's unfold this briefly here. Verse 3, he says, so that it may be well with you, and that you may live long on the earth. I have it here in the ESV, that it may go well with you, and that you may live long in the land. Paul is quoting from the time of the giving of the law in Moses' time. What was God doing in that time? I'm not asking the question, what was he doing when Paul spoke this? What was God doing when these words first came out of God's mind and heart, when he first spoke these? Remember, this is the one of the Ten Commandments, the one that addresses children. He says, honor your father and your mother. And then he gives this promise that it may go well with you and then that you may live long in the land. What was God doing back then? Well, he was giving his people the law so that they were prepared for living under blessing in the promised land. And I want you to follow my logic here. God was giving his people the law because he wanted them to have the structure to be able to live in the new promised land, to live in the promised land with blessing, fulfillment, to live well in the land. So he's describing what life in the promised land is supposed to look like. It starts off with you're supposed to have only one God, not multiple gods. And then it goes on. You get into that second half of the Ten Commandments, or even that fourth one. You're supposed to set aside one day to be a day of rest, the Sabbath day. It's a day when the employer cannot take advantage of his employees. He can't make them work 7 days. He can't abuse their time. You're supposed to let him. He's supposed to rest, and the employee is supposed to rest too. He's describing this blessed way of living. He says you're not supposed to take anybody's life. You're supposed to treat each other respectfully, not kill each other. You're not supposed to take your neighbor's wife. You're supposed to not commit adultery. You're not supposed to lie. It's supposed to be a place where truth dominates. You're not supposed to look at what your neighbor has and covet it. He's describing a blessed way of living, which if everybody actually lived that way, man, everyone would be applying for visas. It would be a fabulous way to live. And in that, he addresses children. He says, oh yes, it's like, and you children, how are you supposed to live in the new land? You're supposed to live honoring your parents. And if you do, this is really going to work well. If you do, you're going to have a blessed life in the new land. Now, that's the context of what Paul is saying now in the New Testament. And I want to take you, and we'll close with this text, to 2 Timothy 3. Go ahead and turn there. I don't have it up on the screen, so I want you to see it. 2 Timothy 3, 1 through 4. Because here, Paul is describing, you could put it like this. He's describing the opposite of what the Ten Commandments were set up to do. The Ten Commandments were set up to be the structure in which the way this blessed new promised land life was going to look like. And if you start going through the Ten Commandments, you realize, wow, if people really lived this way, it'd be great. But now in 2 Timothy, Paul is describing a time, he calls it the last days, in which it's actually the opposite of that. It's not a good time. It's not a good place to live. Look at it. I want you to read it here. But realize 2 Timothy 3, I'll put the reference up in case you get lost there. 2 Timothy 3, verses 1 through 4. But realize this, that in the last days, difficult times will come. All right? We're talking about the last days is really a reference to any, I don't have time to trace it out and show you, just trust me here. It's any time from after Jesus until now, really until Jesus returns. We are in the last days. In the last days, difficult times will come. These are not the blessed times that the law was set up to produce in the promised land, which it didn't do, by the way, but these are now the difficult times. Men will be lovers of self. Remember what I addressed with singles? The complexity of self-centeredness. You know what drives difficult times? Paul lays it out in the very beginning of this description of difficult times. It is people are self-centered instead of being selfless. People, they will be lovers of self, lovers of money. Anybody like that in Calgary? Boastful, arrogant, revilers. What is this one? Disobedient to parents. We'll go on. Ungrateful, unholy, unloving, irreconcilable, malicious, gossips, without self-control, brutal, haters of good, treacherous, reckless, conceited. If you put me on the spot, I don't know if I could even come up with that many adjectives in the moment. You know, to describe just a bad place to live. I mean, does this sound like a place that you would seek to get a visa to live in? It doesn't sound like it to me. He goes on, he says, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God. What? Paul's describing these awful times. What is it like? It's a wild, brutal, arrogant, rebellious time. It's a time driven by self-absorption instead of love for God. And children, oh yeah, they're going to be disobedient to their parents. So children, I want you to look at me for a moment. Why does your obedience to your parents matter? Why does it matter? It is because Christianity, even for children, is living in these brutal, rebellious times in a radically different way. If you go to public school and your classmates are disobedient and dishonoring to their parents, that should not surprise you. That's the times we live in. But you are a Christian. And if you are a Christian, then you should have eyes to see that there is a radically different way to live. Because as Christians, we understand that this life is an anticipation of the life to come. It is preparation for life in the New Jerusalem. So let's go back for just a moment to the giving of the law under Moses. When God gave them the law, it was to prepare them for life in the promised land, to make the life in the promised land the ideal perfect society. And let me ask you, did it work? It didn't work. By the way, it wasn't the first time God had tried this. And I don't like saying God had tried this, but bear with me in that bad way to put it, all right? You see, God made a previous attempt. When things got so bad in the world, He decided to kill everybody with the flood except for one family. Whose family? Noah. And what did He do with Noah? He said, Noah's the only righteous man, so I'm going to save him and his family. And then we'll have a perfect society. Adam and Eve messed up, but Noah's going to get it right. Right? What's the first thing we find Adam doing after he gets out of the ark and after he makes that sacrifice? What's the very next story? It's almost embarrassing to us, isn't it? He gets drunk, he's naked. It's like, where did that come from? You know why that's there? Because He's showing us that Noah wasn't good enough. Ah, okay. Let's try it again. It's like God's saying, let's try it again. Let's do it with Abraham. Abraham was better than Noah. Twice he almost gave his wife away. Remember that? And then what about child rearing? Well, he was pretty good with Isaac, but apparently didn't make it to the third generation because Jacob was a bum. And his sons, except for Joseph, were really bums. Oh, what they need. What they need is a law. Yes, I'll give them the law. And then it will work. How did that go? Not too well, did it? Oh, I'll give them judges. Yes, that didn't go too well. What they need is a king. I'll give them the best one. I'll give them King David. Oh, yeah, except he was a murderer, an adulterer. Then what they need are preachers. I'll send prophets. Surely they'll listen to them. And they didn't. They killed him. And so what does it point us to? It points us to what was the only possibility to make this world that's all messed up, to make it right. What was that? God himself had to come down. Do you see? God himself had to come down. That's why I believe that Jesus is God, because the history of the Old Testament tells us that's the only thing that would work. And God did come down. And when Jesus came down, he put into motion the fix, the remedy for everything that got messed up at the fall. And what is this life? Is it all fixed yet? It's not all fixed yet, but the fix is already in place. The remedy is already done, because when Jesus died and then he rose from the dead, he showed that he fixed it all. And you say, I wish it was all in completion now. The way we live this life is this. We know that the fix has already taken place, but we know it just hasn't come to its completion yet. So we live this life in anticipation, knowing that the victory is done, that one day we're going to live in that perfect society that all through the Old Testament wasn't possible and isn't possible now until Jesus comes back. And so why should children be obedient to their parents? Because that's how it's going to work in heaven. Because we're going to be submissive to God the Father and we're going to love it. And why should we be good parents now? And why should we be single seeking God's kingdom? Because this life points us to that life. Do you see it? May God help us to live that way. Father, thank you for helping us to see beyond ourselves. So open our eyes to see it. And to see that children being obedient to parents is not about convenience, and it's not about behavior and not being embarrassed and getting what, and the child getting what he or she wants. It's not about that at all. It's about what you're doing. About learning to submit to your authority. But we want to. We see it because we know, we see what you're doing. We see what you have done. And we see that there is a heaven that waits, that awaits us, where it will all be fixed. And we want to start living like citizens of that kingdom, not this kingdom. So give us that Christian perspective and help the children here to obey their parents for those reasons. And help parents here to expect that of their children, not for their own convenience, but for the blessing of their child, and because it is what best fits what you're doing in the world. And God, thank you for Jesus, because if he hadn't come down, we would continue in this vicious, rebellious, brutal cycle. But we don't have to do those circles anymore. We can live in the world, but not of it, by having our eyes fixed on Jesus and the gospel story, knowing that the remedy is done. It's been fixed. And even though We don't see the fulfillment of that yet. We know that it's already a done deal because Jesus will return and will take us to that perfect society, that perfect culture, that perfect city. And so thank you for Jesus and for what he did on the cross and for the gospel story. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.